Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast with me, Maya Fisher-French.
And with me, Mapalo Maku.
Each week, we'll be discussing the stories we're working on and which you can read more about in the City Press. So Mapalo, this week, you wrote about the emergency fund. And that's always my biggest, it's like, everyone says, how do I ... And I'm like, have a budget and have an emergency fund. Before you have, do anything else, before you
accelerate, yes.
Have an emergency fund. So tell us why you wrote this article. Why is an emergency fund so important?
Okay, all right. So Maya, you know, I like talking about my own experiences because I think people can relate, right? So, you know, last week we did a podcast, you were down here in Joburg, and I was grumpy, okay?
I was grumpy. We were like, I'm not gonna take 3 deep breaths, just calm down.
Yeah. Only because I didn't have cash flow, okay? So I had tried to register at the beginning of the year for a course in financial markets, and I had no response for the longest time. All of a sudden, they come and say, hey, you've been accepted, you know, there's been a delay, but can you pay this X amount? And I thought to myself, you are completely taking me out of my budget right now, okay? And when I don't have money, I'm grumpy. So I had an emergency fund. I put it in my 7-day notice account. So it's for any emergencies that that can happen. And this time around, it happened to be my studies. So for me, I realized just how important it is to have an emergency fund in that case. So an emergency fund, like I said, I have not known anyone who has never had an emergency, Maya.
Emergencies are part of life. I don't know why we call them emergencies, just call them life or something.
Yeah, life happening, right? So life happens, and what do you have to fall back on? That's the whole point of an emergency fund. What do you call it, Maya? I think you call it something different, isn't it?
Contingency fund.
Yes, your contingency fund, right? So, yeah. So the emergency fund really is for those moments when life happens. And the reason why it's so important is that if you say, you know what, I'll keep on, you know, I'll invest. And if an emergency happens when you're just investing, you might have to access those funds.
That is so key. People don't realize that. And if you're investing long term, and you've got to pull out the stock market or something like that unexpectedly, it can be, you can make a loss.
You can make a really, really big loss. So so that's number one. But secondly, you know, if you don't have an emergency fund, it's very easy to use your credit card or go into overdraft just so that, you know, you can cover that unexpected cost. And I find that that catches up with a lot of people. That's where people end up being in debt because, you know, they didn't have that kitty to save for that tire, to save for those fees coming up unexpectedly. So we end up using the credit card, the overdraft, going into debt just to service those costs that come up unexpectedly.
And, you know, it's such an important point because most people, when we, you know, especially with Money Makeover, when we're engaging with readers who are in debt, it's not always lifestyle. Sometimes it's lifestyle debt. Sometimes it's, look, I just went wild and I bought too many clothes. Like, most of the time, it's an emergency that put them there.
Yes.
Funny enough, medical bills and funerals seem to be the two big ones, which says something about our health. But it is definitely the emergency that tend to get people into financial difficulty. And
that's
the one thing nobody ever thinks about, you know, at all. And the question I have for you, and this is a huge debate that happens around, okay, say you are in debt and you're now trying to get out of debt. So you're wanting to accelerate your debt repayments. You listen to our podcasts on how to get out of debt.
Yes.
But you don't have an emergency fund, which do you prioritize?
Maya, you need to have an emergency fund because of the very thing that we've just spoken about. If you have another emergency and you're still trying to pay off debt, you will go back to dipping into the credit card, dipping into the overdraft. So try and do both. I know, you know, people are cash strapped, but if you don't do that, if you do not have an emergency fund, it's very easy to go back to. So let's say you paid off maybe 5,000 or 10,000 or even 20,000 of your credit card. It's very easy to go back and access whatever you have paid into it. So it really beats the whole purpose of trying to pay off debt in the long run. So by all means, do try to save up a little bit towards having that emergency fund.
So it was quite interesting when I edited the Dave Ramsey's book, Total Money Makeover. Yes. He spoke about, and obviously we had to adapt it for South African scenarios, but he really advised that you have 10,000 Rand, even before you start accelerating that debt repayment, but make sure you first have 10,000 Rand before you do anything else in emergencies. So emergencies can be bigger. So maybe we can talk about how big your emergency fund should be. But his point was, at least have that 10,000 Rand. That's the first step. Then start accelerating your debt repayments and doing everything else.
Yes.
But
yes,
start off with that 10,000. So, I mean, how do you, I know how I reached, funny enough, I must just tell you, I reached my final, I think I always say you should have, what, 3 months emergency funds put aside.
Yes.
I always had like, maybe the 10,000, you know, just like I had a bit of emergency funds put aside, but I never really managed to get to the bigger number. Until I edited his book, because he spoke so much about emergency funds that I was so motivated to do it. So I took my entire payment from that book and I stuck it into, into my emergency fund. Yeah. So sometimes you need that motivation, and sometimes it's that motivation of hearing it, reading it over and over and over and over because you're busy editing it.
It's very important. So that's exactly Maya. So that's one way of saving towards building up or beefing up that emergency fund. So in your case, it was what you call a cash windfall, maybe you can call
lump
it that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get a lump sum, either bonus or, you know, your tax return comes in. So that's one way to beef it up, which is really the easiest way if you do get that bonus, right? So that's the first one. And the second one then, I think especially as a freelancer or someone who earns commission, you can set a certain percentage. So let's say 10% of whatever income that you receive, you will put away towards your emergency fund. And
automate that amount.
I love automation. If I don't automate, I know I'll never get anything done. I know I will buy shoes. I know I will probably go on holiday. If I don't automate my things, for me, my life becomes a mess. So try to make sure that you do automate it. Have a fixed percentage in your mind that you know whenever you receive any income, it does not matter how much it is. If it's 10%, that's the amount, and you put it towards your emergency fund.
And automate, but, I gather you mean by debit order or stop order or instruction.
There you go. And I mean, it's very easy to set it on your internet banking. Mm-hmm. You can simply go to your internet banking and say, okay, when every 25th or the 1st, whatever the case is, you want X amount to be going off your account towards that emergency fund.
So I must just tell you, I do that with a lot of, so I've got, you must see my bank account, I've got like all a whole lot of little savings accounts linked to it, because I've got lots of different things that I do, and I like to put everything different. My husband and I have a very different view on this, but I like everything being different. It's all labeled. It's got like holiday fund and and I do that as well. But the problem is that suddenly you kind of have this money in your bank account, and the next day you have very little money in your bank account. It's kind of a feeling like a drop when you're in an airplane, it sort of drops. It's sort of, it's how you feel. It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yes. You know, Maya, for me, it's, I know people who did seem are going to kill me for this, but I call it zero-based budgeting. So I know where every rent will go. So even if at the end of the day I have 2,000 in my bank account, but I know my emergency fund, there's money in there, my retirement annuity, there's money in there, you know, all this money has gone to where it needs to go. So whatever is left is whatever I can spend guilt-free, which is very important to me.
And that's what we do. You see, so you're getting lessons from people who've made all the mistakes. We won't go into my need for emergency funds and my life story right now, but we've learned that unless the money leaves your bank account very quickly and is hidden in all your pots somewhere, it's going to get hit. So Makhlo, where do you put your emergency fund? Because I think that's the other question we get a lot of. It's like, where should I invest my emergency fund?
100%. And that's very, it is a very important question, Maya. And I would even refrain from saying invested.
So you're quite right. The word invest is completely incorrect. You don't invest your emergency fund.
You don't invest your emergency fund, you save your emergency fund. So it means that it needs to be liquid, it needs to be easily accessible. And there's
not too very, accessible.
Yes, not too accessible. Not your normal transactional account.
Yeah.
Right. So like I said, with my bank, I have a 7-day notice account, right? That I know I can access. Because in the beginning, I would say, oh no, I've saved this much for my emergency fund and it's in my normal transactional account, and I'll be swiping at Woolies.
Yeah.
So my
Woolies is not an emergency.
No, it wasn't an emergency. But the money fund itself, it's into Woolies. So I had to put a 7-day notice to my account and say, okay, this is where I'll be saving my emergency fund. Because like you said, if it's too easily accessible, you might end up spending it on what's not an emergency. So having that layer of protection, if you can call it a notice account. Some people say 32-day notice because they look at the interest, but you have to outweigh if you needed the money within 10 days or 5 days. So you do pay a penalty to access those funds. But sometimes for people, that psychological effect, again, helps them to say, you know what, I will not touch this money. If you're that type of person, then definitely the 32-day notice is much better. It's a much better option for you.
Yeah, and you can break a 32-day notice. It's not, it's not advisable and you lose some of the interest, but you can break it.
Yeah.
So
yes,
I suppose that is part of one of the tricks. And the other things that people use is they often say to me, they use their mortgage bond. So they'll put extra money into their mortgage. And one guy said, well, he's got about 3 months worth of access, if that makes sense, in his mortgage. He's paid ahead by 3 months. I don't like that one. Personally, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, there's absolutely, you're paying off debt, you're paying less interest as a result of it, so effectively there's a net benefit to you. But for me, it's mixing goals. I know the date that I want my mortgage paid off by. I accelerate my payments, I do all sorts of things. If you've got your emergency fund sitting in there, you're not actually sure if that's your emergency fund or it's part of your debt repayment on your bond, your acceleration. I don't know. What are your views with your clients, and what are you generally hearing about that?
Yeah, I do have some people who are saying they do put money into their bond, but when that emergency comes, then they take it out. And remember, different banks have different rules about that access bond. I'm not confident enough to do it that way.
Yeah.
Like you said, I have my calculations. I know instead of paying off our bond in 20 years, we would have paid it off in 16 years with the rate that we're going. So if I do say, okay, I'm going to access it, what does that mean? So do I have to go back to my calculations? For me, it's a bit confusing.
Exactly. I find it confusing. So then am I drawing down this emergency? Am I eating into the extra money that I put in to pay it off quicker? Yeah. So there's no right or wrong answer, but these are we're just really sharing on this podcast what we do and why we do it. And you can decide what maybe you're better at calculating these things.
For me, it just feels like it needs a little bit more time to do all these calculations and go back and forth in my mind. So rather I just use my 7-day notice account.
And then how do you replenish your emergency? So when you've cooled down on your emergency fund,
like you have right now,
how do you set a goal now to replenish it?
So I always have a goal to say, let's say, for example, the 10,000. So my goal is to always have 10,000 in there, right? And now for my fees, I drew 4,500 from them. So I know that one way or another, I need to replenish this. So obviously, if I have one paycheck coming through, I can only put only so much. Because of the work that I do get different contracts, different freelancing jobs. Then I know part of that invoice that I'm going to receive is definitely just going to cover my emergency fund. But for people who have just one fixed income, you just have to say, okay, can I put 1,000 towards this every month until I finally go back to how much I know my emergency fund should be?
So, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think, your emergency fund is a continual living thing.
Yeah,
I've got it, I'm fine, because you're going to be drawing on it. And how do you replenish it? So, absolutely. Yeah. So hopefully our listeners have got a really clear idea now. And really what I would really encourage you to do is listen to this over and over and over again until you're so motivated that you go and start that emergency fund. Because I promise you, it took a lot of reminders of for me, listening to, editing that book to realize that it would make my life. And it has. It has taken away so much stress out of my life.
Absolutely. So it really does go a long way. And you know what, I just want to end off with an example. So one of my clients, when I was doing a coaching session, she's an oncologist, and she knows about emergency fund, but she's like, no, but I do have cash flow. I said, you know what, just have that money designated just for that. And finally it clicked in her mind, you know, the importance of it. She was so extreme. Like she was, she's one of the most extreme clients I've ever had in my life. When the light bulbs turns on, she goes all in. She sold her car, bought a lower model, but I mean, that was part of the plan in any case. And boom, she's just, whatever the difference was, she just put all of it in her emergency fund. And she says, you know what, now I have an emergency fund, never to. But she was so extreme. So there are those people who just catch on one from the first time. Now, Maya, in your article this week, you wrote about short-term insurance. So there's a report that came out from the Ombudsman about all these claims that are disputed. And I think people will really be interested in them because we all know insurance, again, when it comes to claim time, it can be very tricky. What are some of the things that you picked up from that report?
So I think for me, what was really interesting, well, it was interesting and it was not surprising, was that by far the majority of their complaints come around car insurance, vehicle insurance.
Yes.
Because if I see the questions we get from readers, it's not about their household insurance and things, it's actually the car insurance. And I think it's partly because car insurance is quite complex. It's also very emotional. And I think it's really important that, you know, you're sitting there paying a premium every single month. And when the time comes, you have an expectation of what that's going to do for you.
Yeah.
And when I actually chatted to Ayanda Mazwi, she's a senior assistant ombuds at the short-term insurance ombuds. And she was saying to me that, you know, from what I understood, it's a lot of it, we just don't understand what we've bought. And this is where the disputes come. And the problem is that you've been paying this money, you have an expectation, your expectation's not met, but actually that's what you bought. You bought the lower expectation, but you just don't realize it. So
you don't know.
It's so important that when you're buying insurance, that you actually understand what it is. And the big thing she said that comes up, and I promise you, Napolo, the amount of queries I've had from readers on exactly this issue, it's, have you insured at retail value, market value,
market value?
And these are three totally different things. So retail value is kind of the highest amount that you can insure for. So obviously it costs more, but basically it's the amount that if you went to the showroom now and bought that car, obviously the same age, it's not a new car, but say you had a four-year-old Polo or something, and you went and bought that four-year-old Polo, that's pretty much the price you would pay, retail price you would pay. So that's the closest you have to actually completely getting your money for nearly the value of what your car was worth.
Okay.
The next one, the other one is market value. And market value is that awful one where it's the price that the dealer pays for a car at like rock bottom. Okay. So it's like, it's probably a good
trying to buy it off of your hands for way cheaper.
Yes, exactly. So it's a good 20-30% less than actually you're probably paying when you buy the car. So it's at the retail
value.
So a lot of insurance, what happens is you come to insure your car and you want to pay as little premium as possible, and you start comparing premiums, and one guy's a lot cheaper than the other, but you haven't asked that question, what am I going to get paid out? One's paying at retail value and the other at market value. So the other option is to insure a trade value, and trade value is kind of between retail value and market value. So that's the price that the dealers would give you if you brought your car in for a trade-in. So that's kind of the values that you insure at. So I think it was interesting to me because that seemed to be really, really the key driver of many of the disputes.
Mm. So Maya, what other issues outside of the market value, the retail value, did you pick up? I know a lot of people, you know, there's the salvage part. So if the insurance does pay you, some people say, oh, can I still have my car back so I can sell it off for parts or something like that? Is that possible? What are the rules around
that? That's, again, it's what was amazing to me was like, this is, when she said this is one of our big complaints, I thought, oh, you know, how many people have written to me about this as well? So this is exactly it. So say you've now insured your car, and let me tell you, even if you've insured it at market value, okay, and all you're getting is the market value of the car, if that insurer pays you in full for the value that you've insured it for, they keep the wreckage. You don't keep it.
So are you going to get to take your car and sell it off for some parts and make a dime out of it?
No, that's the agreement.
What are they going to do with it?
Because that's the agreement. The agreement is, otherwise, you are enriched. So in the insurance principle, this is very important to understand the insurance principle. You cannot be better off financially after the event than you were before the event. And this applies to things like income protection. You can never insure your income for more than you were receiving.
More than you.
Yeah, it's a basic insurance principle. So if, say, for example, you insured your car for 100,000 rand, you got your 100,000 rand out, and then you wanted to keep the wreckage, you would be in a better financial position. So you can't keep the wreckage. And so what the ombudsman told me was that what people then do is, because they may have sentimental value or they believe they can repair the car. So remember, this could be in a rifle situation, maybe not theft. The car's been in a car accident. You've got a mate down the road who says, no, don't worry, I can fix the car.
I'll fix it up for you. Yeah. Yes. And maybe then you can sell it on.
Yeah. So you'll sell it on exactly to some person who doesn't know it's been in a major accident.
Secondhand market. I know. Cars that have been in wreckages, and you buy it and later you find out that it has been in an accident.
Ah, so this is clearly what people are wanting to do. So they say, okay, thanks for the payout, but I'm going to keep the car because my mate down the road is going to put some paint on it and sell it to some poor unsuspecting victim.
Yes.
And so what you could do is you could say to the insurer, I want to keep the wreckage, the salvage, they call it, but then the insurer then only pays out a portion of the
not 100% anymore.
Yeah. So now though, that's a dispute. Well, I think the wreckage, so say it's a 100,000 rand car, and I think the wreckage is only worth 10,000 rand. I'm expecting the insurer to pay me out 90,000.
Yes.
Not at all. The insurer reduces your payout between by 40 to 60%. By 40 to 60%.
So instead of getting 100,000, you would probably get 60,000 at the end of the day.
Even. Yeah.
So, and you walk away with a wreckage that you still need to fix and
hopefully
that sounds like a mess.
So she really suggested that you don't do that. She said it never really works out. So I said to her, okay, but how do they decide the value of that wreckage? Because that seems to me very much like a thumbsuck that the insurer can really rip people off on, which let's say no more about that. But she said it is based on general guidelines of the South African Insurance Association. So there are guidelines that they apply to how they calculate the value of the wreckage. But to me, I must say, it does sound, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, this guidelines, Maya, so for example, you know, with the market value, retail value, who's supposed to educate the consumer? So like you're saying, you know, at the end of the day, when I'm the person trying to look for insurance, I want to pay the least, right? Who is meant to educate me about all of these things? Because I mean, the documents sometimes are so ridiculously big and the thin lines, and who is supposed to do this education for me?
I mean, obviously the person selling you the insurance. It's usually a salesperson in the process. And that salesperson is supposed to give you all of this information. Now, whether they do or they don't, and they do and you choose to ignore it, you know, it's hard to say. But obviously, but also we're now getting these online insurers, you know, your DIY guys, like Naked, which is just an app. You don't even talk to someone. And I think what they do in their case is they just default. They default only to a specific one. But I think it often now what the insurers are doing is they're actually defaulting to retail value. The higher amount, because they just don't want to have that negative experience at the end. You know, they don't want to have, it's bad for their brand. It's just, even though they're right, you know what perception is reality. So, yep. You know, they don't want people going around complaining about their insurance. They want their insurance brand to be well respected. So a lot of them are trying to encourage people, or may even only default to the retail
one. Yeah.
But I can't say that for everybody. So you need to be checking, and you need to be asking those questions. And I think just generally, whenever you're comparing quotes and there's a big significant difference, ask the questions.
It's very important. What about warranties, Maya? So let's say you've been on a motor plan of some sort, and now it's finished. What about warranties? What can you claim from them? Because it's such a scary world there as well.
I was chatting to her as well and thinking, you know what? And I said, you know, again, one of my biggest complaints, and I have actually looked at some of these warranty contracts. The warranty contract is, you like exactly like you said, it's out of warranty, so you extend the warranty. Yes. And these are private companies, insurance companies, that then say, fine, you know, we'll cover your clutches, your gearboxes, all these things that can go wrong. And that sounds like a really good thing to take out if you have a secondhand car. So a good warranty that is reputable and all the rest of it could really be valuable. But I have seen contracts where it is so, and I mean, she actually acknowledged, she said, we see contracts where it's almost impossible to claim because they have so many exclusions. We don't cover this, we don't cover that, that it's actually not worth the piece of paper it's written on.
Sure. But you're paying a premium every month.
So it is, for me, it's a bit of a systemic problem in the industry. She acknowledged that. And she said what they are actually doing is, so she said, you know, when they get these kind of complaints, they do now look at the contract and see if actually the contract is too complex and technical for the ordinary consumer to understand. And if they find that, then they will obviously find in the favor of the consumer. And, you know, she also said, I mean, her exact words were, the exclusions are so onerous, the consumer has virtually no cover. So obviously in those cases as well, they would rule in favor of the consumer. But what they have introduced is they've now putting in place something called policyholder protection rules. And this makes the insurer has to follow very clear, transparent ways of explaining the information in the documents. So I think that's part of this whole treat your customer fairly focus that we have now with the regulators. So I think it is warranties to me, you know, if you get doing a warranty through a proper insurer or through your car dealer, and you know, it's a lot about, it's about brand, it's about reputation.
Is providing that warranty? Yeah,
exactly. But I think
Do a bit of research as well, and see, you know, go onto the internet and find out, have there been complaints? Have people complained about not getting their claims? You know, so just a bit of research on your part also, I think, goes a long way.
Definitely. And one of the things that I picked up as well when I was going through, when I've looked at these warranties before, is they have this really weird agreement thing where they say it's got to be the primary cause, not the secondary cause. So what they mean by that is, so say, for example, you had an oil leak on your, there was like a little ring that had a small oil leak.
Yes.
But you didn't know that. So 2 months later, something bigger went. It blew something. I'm not going to try and go into car terms. I don't know cars. But it blows something bigger. They will go and investigate. And I'll say, no. The problem was actually that little ring. So therefore, we will pay for the ring that was allowing them. But not the bigger.
Which is about $100.
Yeah.
That you could pay for yourself.
Exactly. So these are, and I'm telling you, I've even come across this in a car dealer who somebody had bought a car from them, and it was still under the proper warranties, so actually under the manufacturer's warranties, and exactly something like that happened to do with her power steering, and it was something little had gone, and then the bigger thing went, and in the end, what they did, she was not covered under their warranty, but in the end, they did something called goodwill, where they acknowledged that she was a good customer, that she'd always bought her cars from them. Yes. So this is I think this is an area that really needs to be investigated. And I think, look, if you've got a warranty that's sort of part of a normal warranty, but if you're going in now paying money for something, is it actually worth it? And I think it's probably one of the questions we need to be asking.
The wild, wild west.
The wild west. And I think finally, the last thing that I was dealing with a Twitter, some guy was complaining on Twitter about his insurance experience. And so I asked her about this because he was saying, that in this case, it had gone to the ombud and he had won. The ombud had ruled in his favor, but it had been 6 months later. And he'd incurred costs of not having a car for 6 months, not having had a payout, because in this case, he said he'd actually have to go and buy another car, pay interest. So the interest that he would be able to settle that with the payment. But it could be that you've had to hire a car or use an Uber during the dispute. And she said they're not allowed to award what they call consequential losses or damages. So the awarding that they'll give will just purely be based on that original contract. They won't give makeup.
What happens in between, you have to sort yourself out.
But she said the only time they may look at that is if they found that the insurer was unreasonable or that the dispute was not based on merit. So many disputes will come to them not because the insurer is a skellum, but that a discussion about the interpretation of something or whatever. But if she finds that the insurer actually acted in bad faith, then they may go and award those damages. So, I mean, I think all of these things are really worth just knowing about and really just knowing your rights and not taking the first answer actually go and dig a little bit more, go back, ask questions. And because I really think when it comes to insurance that, I think there's a lot of fraud and a huge amount of problems that make insurers very sensitive. And obviously they don't want to have to keep putting premiums up because people are defrauding them. But on the other side, I think that often catches out innocent people who have genuinely been paying for something that they believe they're going to receive.
But I think, Maya, also, it's very important, even before you sign on the dotted line, do your homework, do your research, ask questions as many as possible. But what about for those people who are listening and they do have either a warranty or they have an existing insurance? Is it a good time maybe to go back and review what it is that they have?
Go. The brilliant thing. If you're listening to this, quickly go and call up your contract, your insurance contract. Hopefully you've got it somewhere on email. I generally have to now stop searching for these things, but if it's in a file or on your email somewhere, go and check things. Is it market, retail, trade value? What excess am I going to pay? That's another big one. You know, you may have taken the cheapest insurance, now you've got 5,000 rand excess. Make sure you have Muffalo's emergency fund. So go and check all those things. And on the warranties, go and actually try and read through that thing. Because I have read one of those contracts. I mean, I had such a headache at the end. Go read through it, underline, make sure you understand what you've bought.
So that's a wrap for today. If our listeners would like to learn more about these or any money-related topics, they can go to the City Press website, or to your website,
womanandfinance.co.za,
or my website, mayaonmoney.co.za.
And if you have any questions or comments, you can send us a WhatsApp voice note to 064-554-3959. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Because we want to know what it is that you want to know. You've been listening to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast, featuring the contributors of the City Press Personal Finance Pages.